Simon Kirchin is Professor of Philosophy and Dean of the Faculty of Humanities at the University of Kent. And Simon talks about growing up in a working-class family in Dudley and his circuitous route to Kent. He came here in 2003. We find out about Simon's earliest traumatic memory and the important role that rituals and structures played while he was growing up. We find out that Simon is a real Carry On film fan, and we learn about Simon's amateur dramatics predilections. He plays the role of the pantomime dame every year in his local village hall production. He makes a number of insightful observations about the performance nature of lecturing and the links that it has with stand-up comedy. We find out about the influence played by Simon's religious studies teachers at school and why in his professional career he feels that he is the cat that got the cream. And the interview ends with some poignant reflections about whether we could ever be nostalgic about negative experiences and the bittersweet experiences pertaining to romance, and whether there might be certain past experiences that Simon would like to relive. So join me, Chris Deasy, for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week is Professor Simon Kirchin. I am in the presence of greatness. I mean, to have the Dean of Faculty, Simon, in here, that is... We used to be in adjacent offices. Yours was half the size of mine, and now you've got the biggest office in the faculty.
Actually, Chris, I definitely haven't got the biggest office in the faculty. I won't tell you as... Got the biggest office in the faculty, it's not me.
Yeah. Well, I'll interview them next, and then we'll compare sizes of offices. Anyway, so glad to meet you. And also, my sense, because I've only been on social media in about 9 months, which actually surprises some of the people who've recently become friends on Facebook, but it's people have said that about me. You learn more about somebody sometimes through their online posts, and the sense of being yourself you're wearing a different sort of hat. Some of my, as I joke to some people, I'm channeling my inner eccentricity through social media. So, it'll be interesting to see what we know, because we were neighbours for many years.
We were. In that tiny little enclave of George Allen Ring, which people found it very difficult to find, which had its benefits, I think.
Well, and of course, doing student support as well, from my point of view, it was, you know, pluses and minuses. The students had to see me, but they had to be led by somebody else. Anyway, so give me a bit of background, because we were here, I mean, you actually came here, I think, a year before me.
That's right, I did.
Yeah, and actually the first time I met you, it was actually really embarrassing, because Jeremy Corrett and I were appointed at the same time, and I'd met Jeremy at the interviews, and then I saw you coming out of what was your office, and I knew that Jeremy was going to have an office down there, and I thought you were Jeremy, and I said something like, oh, it must be great to start, and, you know, we're in the same department. You were thinking, who is this really weird guy who's making absolutely no sense? And 15 years on, who is this guy who's making absolutely no sense? So that's great. Anyway, so you came here in 2003. Tell me a little bit about your sort of trajectory before that. Because you're from Dudley, is that right?
That's right. So I'm from Dudley in the West Midlands, in the Black Country. So I was born in 1974. I suppose the best way of encapsulating all that trajectory is that, you know, my mum and dad, you know, very briefly, kind of very working class. So, you know, kind of, you know, lots of terraced houses in Dudley in the Black Country. Grew up in that very, you know, industrial part of the world, and they moved out to the nicer bit of Dudley, which is where I grew up, so right on the cusp, the West Midlands cusp of all the brown and grey on maps on one side, then all the green and fields until you hit kind of mid Wales on the other side. So that's where I grew up, and I, you know, went to my local state schools, state sixth form, had a very good time, explore that a bit more. And I was just this aberration, because my mum and dad left school when they were 15 and 16, no qualifications whatsoever, went into work. And I was this aberration, where I was this clever kid who ended up going to Oxford for my undergraduate years, which was just bizarre. And then I did my PhD at Sheffield, and then I had a succession of temporary contracts at Bristol. After being at Sheffield, and then I landed up here at Kent in 2003, after many interviews across a number of different departments. Perhaps we'll talk about that as well.
Well, I've read your interview that you did for the What Is It To Be A Philosopher?
Yeah.
And that was really insightful, because I think you said that by the time you came to Kent, you'd had so many interviews, you were sort of thinking, what is the strategy I must adopt?
That's right, yeah. So I think I said that in the interview, I'll say again that across 4 years, ending at Sheffield and through my time in Bristol, I think I held up the all-comers record in my peer group for number of interviews. So I had 19 interviews. And in fact, I didn't get a single job. So the job at Bristol I was second for, and a friend of mine got the job, and then soon after he started, he got a permanent job at Birmingham. This was a one-year job. So I did the second 5 months, and I ended up just staying on a succession of 5 months contracts there. And then similarly at Kent, I came second at that interview. But the person that they gave the job to ended up getting a permanent job at their own department. And they said, look, I'll come to Kent, but I'll be resigning straight away to go back to my home department. And Kent were very good and said, look, just go straight away. So I got a phone call kind of the second, third week of August saying, would you like to start a permanent job in 1st of September? So that was kind of a big life change. So I was incredibly lucky. So I think I'd earned my spurs as well by that point.
Absolutely. And in my case, actually, I was really lucky that they made two appointments, right, because I had Jeremy Correct was infinitely more qualified than myself. So when I learned there were two appointments, I never asked the question, who was number one? But I think it's safe to say that Jeremy was, really? I think Jeremy was a far more prestigious person than I was. So two appointments at once. And we're both still here and never looked back. But the thing that I really find difficult to deal with sometimes at those interview situations is when you meet people that you know who are going for the same jobs and you've seen them at other interviews.
Yes.
And you know that although you have a lot in common, because in terms of disciplinary work, you obviously share a lot in common. You're both, in my case, religious studies scholars. But at the end of the day, you both desperately need that job and you're up against each other. And I find that, just really sad. I mean, it's a fact of life. If you're a politician and you want to be in the cabinet, then you know who you're up against in terms of the competition. You may be good friends. But, I think that, there are whole careers at stake and livelihoods depend on it and families depend on it. So it all worked well in the end, but yeah. Goodness me, 19.
I mean, you're right though, there is that interesting aspect of interviews, particularly in this country where candidates tend to meet each other. Of course, in other countries like in the US, they are at great pains to make sure that candidates don't meet each other. I know this, not that I had any interviews in the States because I decided not to go for the American market, but I was visiting North Carolina Chapel Hill for a time, and it just happens that interviews were going on at that point, so I had an insight into what they were doing at the time and what still goes on. So they were planning it meticulously so that candidates didn't even bump into each other at the airport. Whereas here, there's that kind of, almost certainly amongst philosophers at that time, it was a kind of esprit de corps, camaraderie. Oh, look, I'm seeing you again. Like, here we are again, and so we're having we're all going for our presentations and interviews in the middle. We've got these horrible kind of corporate sandwiches that we have to eat and make small talk over.
Well, I had an interview at Liverpool Hope in 99, and one of the other candidates had already worked there, so knew the institution well, and she invited me and the other candidates out to one of the local pubs where they were doing karaoke, and I thought, is this some sort of test? She actually another candidate, or is this is she actually a spy?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, so I remember some interviews where at the end of the day, because of where it was geographically, some of us weren't going home straight away, we were staying overnight, so we all just went out for a meal just together without the department. It's not nice.
Yeah.
And so there is that element of competition, but there's also an element of all being in it together. Right.
But it's also life, isn't it? You're always going to, you have to deal with those situations, like it or not. But going back a little bit further, you mentioned your parents were working class.
Yeah.
What did they do?
Okay, so my mum worked in banks for a whole working life, Barclays Bank. And so when she left 16, entered the bank, always what she wanted to do. And for a time, she helped to set up the very early computer network across the West Midlands. And then after doing that, she became a cashier just at the local Barclays Bank near where we lived pretty much for all her life. My dad, he was a sales estimator for various foundries and factories, and actually so rather than being a salesman or sales rep, that word estimator is really important to get a sense of where we lived. So my dad worked in a foundry for quite the same foundry when I was growing up, and like 95% of their business was Ford you know, the big factories in Birmingham. So even though they did business with other people, it was mainly Ford, and he was just estimating, you know, how many widgets they need to make, how many castings they could make every month, what the materials cost, what the men cost, and therefore what he was negotiating with Ford over the time. So that's basically what he did for a lot of his career. And then he worked at other sorts of factories and foundries as well.
Yeah.
And then they both retired a few years ago.
Yeah. No, my dad worked on the railway for 48 years.
Oh, wow.
Although in the last 10 years, the job title changed because of privatisation.
Yeah.
But he was effectively worked for from the very bottom right up to management level. But yeah.
I mean, the interesting thing about my mum and dad, of course, is that they work in class, and there's all those norms about, you know, when you had your meals and what you called them and the sort of TV you watched and, you know, what decorations you had in your house and all that sort of thing. I think the best way of encapsulating, they were kind of aspirational working class. So both my mum and dad had office jobs rather than, you know, factory or foundry floor. But even so, lots of those, thinking about, you know, this nostalgia, you know, the sort of home environment I grew up in and you know, all those, as I say, norms and social mores that you have, they were very much working class.
Mm. And what about very earliest memories?
Goodness, well, because you asked me this in preparation for the interview. So my earliest memory, you'll understand why it's my earliest memory. I think I must have been about two or something, and it was, I've got a slightly strange shaped nail on my index finger of my right hand, and it's because I shut the car door on my hand and my nail has grown awkward ever since. That was my earliest memory of huge amounts of pain.
So trauma.
Trauma. But other than that, earliest memories are very good. You know, just general things about, you know, seeing friends. I mean, they're growing up and, you know, seeing friends in the park and playing in the garden and family events and Christmas and Easter and, you know, all that sort of thing. So,
yeah, it's interesting because my own research, I recently did a book on Christmas, and I think for me it's trying to get to the heart of, you know, why in our childhood these are things that matter, and they still matter as you grow older, and we try to escape those rituals sometimes.
Yeah.
We think, oh, I cannot go through another Christmas with those same people, with this, you know, it's too much, too stressful. But of course we do. My grandfather always used to say things like, when he was into his 90s, he said, right, that's it, I'm just going to have beans on toast next year, I'm going to, you know. But of course he always, you know, there always was a sense that you had to mark it out differently. And we are beholden. Actually, I was just saying, when I came in, I saw a film last night called Hereditary, and that sense of being beholden to one's past, although not with some of the malevolence of that film sort of entails, but you know, I think that's an important thing, and those memories do form us. And if I was going to be trite, of course, you know, you mentioned your earliest memory is pain. Well, you know, 19 interviews, you know, sometimes but sometimes it's those childhood events, I think, that, you know, on a serious level do frame us, you know, and sort of give us that sort of stamina, because sometimes there's a resilience which I have in different situations, and I think, well, where has that come from? You know, have I inherited it? Have I learnt it through experience? And I think sometimes a good way to channel that is by going back, which is why the Nostalgia Project is important.
I mean, there's a certain amount of comfort as well to all of those, particularly about Christmas and Easter and all those things. So, in fact, so my wife and I, we've got two kids. We've been conscious, actually, of creating those memories and creating particular traditions. So various things come out at Christmas, certain sort of decorations, we do things in a certain sort of order. I mean, so we've got a particular CD, John Denver and the Muppets, which Penny and I saw when we were engaged at a you know, market in Devon. We just bought it, and it just cost us £2. But actually, we put it on every year, and it's kind of that's the thing that means Christmas. It would be awful if we lost that CD and couldn't play it anymore.
Mm.
I mean, simply at Easter, pretty much every year since we've been married, we go to Somerset, because that's where my in-laws have lived for many years. That's where, you know, Penny spent her teenage years, certainly, and then growing up. But my in-laws have recently moved. They moved, in fact, to Kent to be closer to us. And so this year, it's the first Easter where, for years, where Penny hasn't been in Somerset, and she really felt that lack. So you're right about doing things in the same sort of way, you know, still having, you know, turkey and all the trimmings or whatever you have. If you didn't celebrate Christmas, if you used to celebrate Christmas with all your family, and then suddenly you're not doing it, you get to genuinely think, God, there's that real hole, real kind of, real, it's really missing. And certainly I'm that sort of person who would likes that rhythm to the year, likes to do things in
sort of. And I think having those structures, I find that certainly in terms of my daily life. You know, I come to work every day, but it almost, if I didn't have something like the cinema to go to of an evening or see my children on the weekend, you know, that sort of balance is so needed, because if you fall out of balance, you know, what do? Do you start drinking, or do you just sit and watch the TV? You know, for me, there always has to be some ritual. For me, I think because I'm a diary keeper, there's almost a sense in which there always needs to be some sense of structure or design, otherwise the whole thing becomes random.
Yeah, that's right. I'm just like that, Chris, so I'm very conservative with a small C about these things, about when I get up, sort of breakfast I have. I mean, it's even, you know, that gets down to very, very dull details, that if I don't have a big mug of tea at certain points in the day, then I know I'm going to get a headache because my body's been used to that sort of rhythm.
Yeah, I find that with coffee. Yeah, if I don't go to the Gulbenkian for at least two coffees a day, I feel that I've somehow, it's equivalent to getting out on, you know, the wrong side of bed. For me, when I was growing up, it was always the charts. Yeah. It was always that sense of, you know, I still find that now. It's the music from that era. It's quality proof. It doesn't matter how rubbish it was. It could have been Five Star. It could have been Tiffany, Belinda Carlisle, whatever it was. It's something that is very intrinsically related to my youth, and I can't shake that, nor do I want to do that. Right. And in your case, did music, particularly pop music, play any sort of role in?
Yeah, it did. I mean, certainly, you know, we're similar sort of age. So American MOR during the 80s. So,
oh, like REO Speedwagon.
Sort of thing. No, not so much. But yeah, but like Tiffany, you know, Five Star, all that, you know, stuff. I mean, stuff that, you know, when I was a kid was okay, didn't much like, and then I left it behind. So becoming a teenager, very much American college rock and indie bands in the UK, 4AD label, etc. I think the defining thing for me, though, is more TV programmes. So I was a real TV addict. Any sort of game shows, any sort of comedy shows. I mean, you know, I can still, you know, hum and indeed know all the lyrics to all these programmes that I watched. I know the rhythm of all the programmes about, you know, game shows about, you know, what you went through, the different stages. And it's very interesting as well, because I mentioned my wife. So Penny, she was born in Bristol, but then they went to live in Bermuda for quite a few years, and then they came back when she was about 12, 13. So there's that formative years of about 10 years where there's all these shows, kids' shows, but also stuff on TV, which I know completely, and then it's a complete black hole for her. Because even though she was in Bermuda, which is British-owned, it was American-influenced culture. So that's a kind of real difference between us. But yeah, for me, it was TV, all sorts of TV.
Although I'm quite embarrassed by some of my old diaries. I was saying this in one of my earlier nostalgia interviews, where it almost felt as though, particularly in half terms or on weekends, the diary from when I was 10 years old or early teenage was all about the Carry On films that were on a Saturday night. And I kind of missed that. And, you know, in a way with... because I think Carry On films, I think...
I'm a big fan of those.
And I find that the Carry On films for me were very peculiar, because they started out with the sort of nod, nod, wink, wink in the sort of age. They were ahead of their time in the ones in the late 50s, early 60s. You know, Kenneth Williams was almost sort of the winking at the audience saying, we know we're crossing a line here. Yeah. But when you sort of pass the sort of, you know, when being promiscuous was, you know, sort of post 67 was all right, then they were strangely reactive. Yeah. And you then had the sort of the Kenneth Williams character with all the sort of, oh, you can't do that, you know, I can't do the Kenneth Williams voice. But I thought that was really interesting. So it was almost as though they were ahead of their time, late 50s, early 60s, and then they were completely, by the time you had the Carry On Girls or the Carry On England or Carry On Behind or whatever, then they kind of felt that they'd passed their time.
Dated.
So they were, I mean, so I was watching these obviously growing up, same era as you. Sort of for me, it was sort of particularly early to mid 80s.
Yeah.
And I was too young to really understand a lot of the innuendos. But it's funny watching those same Carry On films decades later and suddenly thinking, you know, I just thought it was good, wholesome family entertainment, but no, they were actually
in so in fact, so I mean, of course,
we watched
them with the kids, because in fact, in terms of, I mean, obviously it's not the height of, you know, satire, but there, some of them are, the writing is really good, and actually there's some really good jokes in them, and partly we'll get onto this, I'm sure, in a bit, because we involved a lot in amateur dramatics, the pantomime in the village, and Penny normally writes the pantomime. So in fact, you know, she never watched them as a kid, so she's watching them for the first time, right? But of course, we're watching them with our kids, and so there's various points where we have to say, draw attention to the misogynistic or sexist attitudes that are going on. But actually, it's been quite good, because then we have a discussion as a family about why these things are wrong, but why they happened and why they're dated and all that sort of thing. So we explore them with the kids.
Absolutely. And actually, I saw the Dam Busters for the first time at the cinema the other, literally about a week ago, and there was a disclaimer at the beginning saying some of the language used in this film. We haven't edited because we think this is historical record, because it was made mid-50s, obviously set a decade or a decade and a half earlier. And perhaps the same with the Carry On films. They really are a slice of social history. Yeah. And they become almost, not so much quality proof, but there is something about the mores of that period, which I think the films themselves... I mean, this is my general view on censorship. I think that they're important as a historical record, but we're right to critique them. Yeah. But I'm not sure we should be going back and editing them in the way that, like those old Bruce Willis films, sometimes they, if they were shown before The Watershed, they take out all the F words. Yeah. And you end up with something that's like, well, actually, the film has now been distorted. It's actually been completely, you know, revisited. It's like somebody doctoring an essay or a book that you've written because they want to sanitise it.
I mean, I think, you know, thinking then about TV... I mean, there were certain sitcoms in the 70s which I saw repeated when I was, you know, a kid in the 80s, and then certain sitcoms in the 80s which were quite blatantly racist. But I think the interesting thing is that, certainly as a kid growing up, you know, I realised they were racist, and indeed homophobic and so on. And I think, you know, there are some people who wouldn't mind that. Even I minded that, and so there were certain sitcoms that even as a kid I felt uncomfortable watching and didn't want to watch.
Yeah.
But you're right, actually, I think... My when it comes to these sorts of cultural artefacts, I think it's right to have disclaimers, let's say, on Dam Busters, but to leave them as they are, and then to critique them, to think about them, and think about why they were as they are.
Mm.
I mean, there's I think probably more serious examples of this sort of issue, which aren't kind of supposed to be comedy things, and then, you know. I mean, actually, I was writing, thinking about something the other day, talking to someone about something, about all the Cecil Rhodes statue in Oxford and all those sort of things. Whereas I think we're into a different sort of territory, even though there's a certain amount of continuity there.
Mm, absolutely. But you mentioned Amdram. Yeah. That's something I didn't know about you until only quite recently.
So you looked on Facebook,
right? Yes.
And you see what I get up to in my spare time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think a number of people around the university know this, partly because I ambush them and show them photographs, because I'm a shameless exhibitionist. But yeah, so we do a fair number of Amdram in the village. In fact, I'll start at a different point. So when I was growing up, loved comedy. And in fact, I used to just do impromptu performances, I was always telling jokes, had loads of joke books as a kid. And then when I went to Oxford, sixth form college, but certainly when I was at Oxford, I was doing lots of performing and certainly lots of sketches with friends. And that kind of died away a bit, even though, then I became an academic, right? So I could lecture. And that's a sort of performance. Certainly for first years, I used to enjoy mixing, you know, philosophical work and just keep, you know, thinking about the narrative and using jokes. But yes, so now for the last few years I do Amdram, and we've got a very strong Amdram group in our village, because we live in Ash near Sandwich. In fact, a number of people in the university are part of it. And the big thing we do every year is the pantomime, so we do that in late January. Penny has written it for the last 6 years, our kids are in it. And I'm last few years I've been into as well, I normally play the Dame, which is just the best part, because you get to have all sorts of double entendre and make merry. And I get to dress up and wear fantastic frocks and wigs. And we also do some other things, well, not just about me dressing up as a woman and making, you know, crude jokes at everyone's expense. So we, you know, we've also done some improv murder mysteries as well, and they've been really good.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I mean, in my case, for years I felt when I came here that if people knew that my tastes were quite sort of lowbrow, I mean, literally, you know, Diet of Radio 1 and Radio 2, and actually emulating the presenters, but I realised this is the crucial thing. The teaching that I do now and the way that I structure my teaching and the voice that I have is very much modelled on, or not consciously, but I've certainly developed it, I think, from growing up with that sort of excitement. You know, if I put the radio on, it's not about the music, it's about the person who speaks in between the songs, who brings it all together. So my memory of, you know, I asked earlier about the charts, for me in the early 80s, it was the presenters. It was Mike Reed on The Breakfast Show. Yeah. And it was that was the link. The records were great and they were important in their own right. But it was the context and the continuity that was provided by the broadcaster. And so for me, people like Ed Stewart and certainly Tony Blackburn, it was the way in which they literally, I would think, you know, they know how to control it. It was almost as though they were attaching themselves. The whole body was, you know, slithering around that microphone.
Yeah.
And I just noticed the other day, it wasn't intentional, but I did one of my Facebook posts in Herne Bay just before I left. I think you may have seen it. And I was doing this post and I was turning around and thinking, oh, isn't it beautiful behind me? And, you know, I'm moving house on the weekends and all the rest of it. And then got back to my flat and saw Tony Blackburn from earlier that day doing one of his posts on Radio Berkshire or Radio 2 outside the studio saying what he's going to be doing in the next couple of hours. And I thought, you know, unconsciously, that is exactly what I'm doing. Yeah. And I actually think, great, you know, but rather than do what I did a decade ago, which was to feel that people might think, oh, Chris, we can't take him very seriously. You know, now I'm not worried about whether people take me seriously, because I feel that I found my voice. And it sounds like you've done the same.
Yeah, certainly. I certainly think about my lecturing style and teaching style. I've thought a lot about that, you know, ever since I started teaching, you know, way back in when I was a PhD student at Sheffield. And so the people who I first think about are performers, actually stand-up comics. And I've always thought about the difference, but also similarity, between being a stand-up comic and being a lecturer, or indeed running a seminar, the different things. Although, for me, particularly at second and third year level, there's a very blurred line between how I run a seminar and how I run a lecture. But it's all about that rhythm and narrative. I think in philosophy, in lecturing, it's very important to be upfront about what you're delivering and what the conclusion might be. You don't want to have a big reveal at the end, but in comedy sometimes you do, so there's that difference there, but still there's a sort of interesting narrative that goes through, and about how you inhabit a persona as a lecturer, where you stand in the room, how you engage with the audience, you know, eye contact, certain sorts of tricks that you might try. So I've thought a lot about that through my career, and in fact, so if I'm thinking about how I'm lecturing, then I'm normally thinking first of all about stand-up comics rather than DJs. And particularly, it's different again for conference presentations. So in fact, unprompted, I remember there was a conference I did two or three years ago now, and someone came up to me afterwards saying, "Goodness, that was just like a Stuart Lee performance." You know, and actually I took that as a huge compliment. Wow. It wasn't deliberately designed to be, but they just the mannerisms as well as the speech patterns, they thought it was a lot like Stuart Lee.
I find that when you go to a conference and somebody might be presenting the most erudite of papers and they've done a lot of work on it, but sometimes it is the performance that is what you,
the audience and the reaction.
Yeah, and the lack of eye contact. And so somebody can have the most erudite of papers, but the thing that you remember sometimes is the way that they deliver that.
Yeah.
And, you know, decades on, if I think back to conferences I went to 20 years ago, I remember the performance rather than the content of the paper.
Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting skill. But I think it also comes with experience, because you know that, you know, there have been occasions sometimes when you have to think on your feet and you don't have a script in front of you. You've got a class of students and you literally have to do things spontaneously.
Yeah.
You might be asked last minute, can you just speak about the module specs of it, you know, or speak about what's on the curriculum for the following year? And sometimes I suddenly think, I can do this,
yeah.
But you know, I'm not beholden to a script.
That's right. I mean, that comes with either natural ability or just having done it for quite a few times, you know, having that confidence. I mean, going back, you know, I always remember this. You know, this is now nostalgia, right? So talked about a little bit about my sixth form college, so perhaps I'll talk a bit more about that, and this will lead directly into what we've just been talking about. So to give people a sense of where I was, lots of the schools where we were, the secondary schools, they deliberately closed down their sixth form colleges, and so three LEAs got together and created four or five really big sixth form institutions, some which specialised in A-levels, some B-tech, some both, right? And so all the kids went to different places. So I went to this sixth form college. Fantastic, because it was a really nice halfway house between school and university life. We had lots of freedom to do our own thing. That's where I started doing lots more performance. Anyway, and so we did like loads of different things. And so I remember once we were doing a political debate, and I'd agreed to, you know, stand up and do a debate. You know, kids at that age do. And it was the first time really in my life when I'd actually had to do that sort of thing. I looked at the audience, there were 60, 70 people in the audience, and actually halfway through I dried up. And I just couldn't go on, I just panicked, just froze. And so the other person I was, who was my pair in the debate, took over. And after that I thought, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. I wouldn't have expected that I'd have been the sort of person who did that, because normally I'm quite confident. I said, I'm never going to do that again. So every, you know, from then I just taught myself how to prep, and also how to imagine myself in the room, what things I would say, what questions there might be, or comments or something, and then how I'd react. And that was a kind of defining moment for me in my life, actually just drying up, freezing. Mm. I thought, I'm never going to do that again, because I surprised myself. I thought, I can't believe
it. And I've seen lots of comedians who do the same thing. Mm. When I was at Lampeter in my, I think my second or third year, it was a Christmas event. Everyone had had a few drinks, and they'd invited some on the up comedians, and both of them made the classic mistake of not understanding their audience. And we're making jokes about students, like it was like the first week of December, because term ended on like the 10th. It was like, oh, you know, typical students. It's not yet Christmas. There's a whole month to go before Christmas. And yet, you know, any excuse for a party. And of course, somebody shouted out something really properly rude and started heckling. But they couldn't go on with it. They had their lines prepared, yeah. And they didn't understand the audience. What, in terms of what made you go into university, what were the particular inspirations? Were there any particular teachers who made you think, wow, this is what I want to do?
Yeah, so definitely. So I've talked before about my sixth form college. And those 2 years were really formative years for me. So I studied maths, economics, religious studies. And in religious studies, we did quite a lot of philosophy, and the two religious studies teachers were really inspirational guys. So they gave us lots of material to do the A-levels with, they talked us through it, but actually they had quite a lot of guests who came in, and this would be quite a bit of a curveball. So one of them in particular was fascinated with evil, and so we had quite a lot of people who came in who were connected with high profile murder cases and that sort of thing, to really investigate psychology of evil and how that meant for religion and philosophy. So that's the point where I started reading loads of Dostoevsky and other sorts of people. But I realised that the philosophy in particular was the thing that was really turning me on. So I thought, that's definitely what I want to study at university. And so I thought at that point, wow, what I really want to do is teach and really get into this stuff. And so around about 17, 18, that's what I really wanted to be, actually, being academic. Before that, I wanted to be a chef. But it was that point that I really decided to, you know, academia. So, I mean, this is a serious point. Despite all of the trials and tribulations that we all suffer in academia, the fact that I'm, you know, age 44 now, had an academic career is just amazing. So I come in every day thinking, aren't I lucky doing this job? That's a serious answer. The facetious answer of why I got into, to the question of why I got into universities is that, you know, I watched all these academics going to work, being respected, doing what they wanted, and they didn't have to wear a suit, because I really don't like wearing a suit. So I thought, that's the job for me. And then I ended up being dean, having to come into work every day wearing a suit.
Yeah, and the irony has not been lost on us, no. Simon. Yeah, yeah. No, but you know, sometimes you literally grow into a job, and
yes,
I think,
right.
And in a way, you can let the job define you, or you can define the job. And I think it's pretty obvious what, you know, in terms of the answer that you've just given, which side of the divide you fall in. I mean, yeah. From my point of view, I'm somebody who will be driving in on a Monday morning, thinking, yes, I can't wait to do whatever. And sometimes I get frustrated because I don't get to do half the things I plan to do. You know, Monday is going to be this in the morning, that in the afternoon. But then again, if everything was that wonderfully structured and regimented, I probably would get bored very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nice thing, I think, about an academic career, broadly speaking, in that there's a whole range of things that we can do. Of course, the bad thing is a whole range of things we have to do, that we expect to do. But you can do through your life, through being an academic, you can actually do lots of different things at different times, concentrate on different things. And that should keep your interest. I mean, there's all sorts of negative things we could talk about, but there's that fantastic thing where you can, you know, be teaching a lot, you can be researching a lot, exploring your ideas, the interplay between those, and not just talking with students, but talking with, you know, wider communities, whatever those communities are. I mean, that is just fantastic.
And in terms of what happened when you were an undergraduate, for example, were there influences in terms of, say, sport or film or politics or religion? These are very big questions, but you mentioned doing religious studies at A-level. And one thing that I've often found with some wonderful colleagues in both philosophy and religious studies here at Kent is that often there isn't the greatest of meeting of minds, but often a lot of respect. And we've had the wonderful Richard Norman and Robin Gill, or Lawrence Goldstein, of course, would do these almost like stand-up acts, actually, which got all the audience in. And we'd all do the thing which, actually, in my recent interview with William Rowlandson was identified as something of a problem, the binaries. You know, which side are you on? Are you in favour of God, or are you the atheist? You know, but everyone was put into camps. And although I don't like binaries, the fact that it got everybody galvanised, I think, was really important. But for you, doing religious studies at A-level, did you find religion playing a particular influence in your life?
Yeah, well, so I'm born and bred Methodist. So my dad was Church of England, but, you know, was based there because he loved the singing. My mom's born and bred Methodist and very much, you know, still a believer, a very strong believer. So I was brought up, you know, Methodist church, and that influenced me both religiously but also politically as well. I mean, now I'm someone of very little, if any, faith, but certainly that word you use, respect, great respect for church and its and what it does. I can see the downsides of it completely, but actually there's a lot that I value in church life in this country. I mean, particularly mainly kind of the liberal welcoming spirit that some church traditions have, and also that community aspect. I don't like these divide. I mean, I can understand why you'd have them for, you know, guest lectures and getting students and that, you know, that galvanising thing. But I find that some of these questions are a lot more tricky than all these binaries would suggest, really.
Although that's often a really good way into the debate, I suppose. Absolutely. But afterwards we find the subtleties. I remember it was Lawrence Goldstein and Robin Gill. And you were there, and I think you said afterwards, Chris, it was clearly a clear win for the philosophers. So I was like, no, of course not. But of course, reinforcing the binary division, which I just said was inappropriate. But no, but I always remember sitting there and thinking that I'd just done a lecture with my students that morning, and we were looking about whether shopping is a religion or film is a religion. So I was thinking, it's not all about God. And of course, that's a big, you know, issue for me, which is peculiarly, I suppose, also helped me with my own research, you know, nostalgia or Christmas or film. It's like, what is this, you know, this concept of religion? How does it apply in different contexts? But often I come a cropper personally when then, although I'm thinking in with that sort of methodological lens or conceptual lens at the forefront of my mind, and then somebody, and it might be a family member or somebody in the shops, who will suddenly say something which is simply about, you know, do you believe in God? And I'm like, oh, I can't answer that question. You know, I can talk around, I can skirt around it, but ask me a direct question like that and I become babbling and incoherent. And it's happened on many occasions because I'm trying to work out where that person is taking me.
That's right. And also the audience as well. So what do you know, if I say yes, I do, part of that hangs on what they're interpreting by belief in God in that sort of instance.
Yes, I remember one situation about a year ago when I'll just say somebody who was a UKIP supporter was asking me questions about particular faith groups in this country. And I was like, do you know, I so don't want to have this conversation on so many levels. So, you know, I'm sort of trying to, you know, talk about something else. So, but my subject does do that. But also I've got to take some responsibility here that, you know, you can't have your cake, you know, and eat it as well. Going back, actually, though, you were saying a moment ago that negative experiences can sometimes be productive or efficacious, or they can challenge. But I was going to ask the question about whether, you know, your memories are predominantly positive, or whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. But was there anything that in particular you wanted to build on in that respect?
Good questions. There's a number of things in there. So most of my memories are positive, but that's because I'm the sort of person who's had an attitude through life where, partly because I've been, you know, blessed generally, but, you know, I've had very positive experiences. You know, school life was broadly okay, university, etc. Even though I could probably pick out lots of things that were trials, such as nighting interviews to get an academic job, or, you know, various bits of bullying at school and that's the sort of thing. But I suppose that the ones that stand out are thinking about the question about whether certain sorts of negative experiences one can be nostalgic about. Look back and think, that was formative, I got something out of that. Do I wish it could happen again? Well, almost. And that's kind of bittersweet experiences about romance. That's the one that gets me. I think, well, it would be, you know, at the time, being a teenager in love or being a 20-something in love and that, you know, unrequited love and so on. Do I wish I were there again? Well, in one sense, no. But in another sense, there was that kind of period of my life. It was kind of bittersweet. And there's something about that I'm sort of nostalgic for. Not that though I'm very happily married, because I hope Penny will listen to this. But there's something about that. If you are thinking back to the past, about times you'd like to be, it's not as if I would like to go back to my 20s and excise that aspect of it. That would be an interesting aspect to relive and experience.
No, for me, I'm often, let's use the word nostalgic about relationships that I never had. In other words, relationships that I might have had, maybe the more confident 40-something-year-old now, thinking back to the 19-year-old self and thinking, could I have asked that person out?
Yeah.
But I didn't. But also, this is the crucial question, would I ask that person out now? Because it's easy to say 25 years on, oh, I would have done this and I would have done that. But really? And often even now I find myself in situations where you're thinking, oh, I'm in exactly the same position as I was. You know, we were talking about the confidence that you have in a lecturing situation when, you know, I've got 40 students in front of me. I have to be, in some sense, in control. There has to be an authority. There has to be a level of professionalism, you know, at work here. But outside one's comfort zone, sometimes I feel I'm often regressing to that sort of, you know, that slightly awkward or very awkward 17, 18-year-old self who doesn't quite know how to handle certain situations. But actually, it's all part of character building.
That's right.
And I wouldn't want it to be otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, so that, there's that point about nostalgia is something slightly different. So I can, you know, one can appreciate that it was good that I did it. Would you want to relive it? And actually, there's part of me that would think it wouldn't be such a bad thing to go through it again. There's that kind of mixture of emotions and feeling mixed up that actually is kind of, I mean, I wouldn't want to relive it for years, but just going just a taste back into it, and just thinking about what it was like really to be me at that point, there's something interesting.
That's why I really struggle, and I have had people say to me over the years things like, oh, you're looking at nostalgia, and not actually in an academic context, but in a personal context, people have said to me, and actually I think they've subsequently changed their mind, but they've said something along the lines of, oh, you know, you're stuck in the past, you should look to the future. And I'm thinking, but nostalgia is not all about being backward looking.
It's
like, you know, we use in theology, you know, the work of Jürgen Moltmann, you know, this sense sometimes that it's the future that pervades the present and the past. And, you know, and the film that I was just talking about earlier, Hereditary, is exactly about that. The idea, and Augustine talked about concupiscence, but the idea that actually there are certain things that you inherit which you can't shake off. And the older you get, I remember my mum actually saying once, she looked herself in the mirror when she was in her late 60s, early 70s, and she saw effectively her mother looking back at her, because she suddenly thought, for the first time in her life, I look like my mother. And prior to that, she thought, I'm so different from my mother. But it's interesting how that happens. And also, it's not just the looks, it's the personality, it's the character. And of course, it's often what other people see.
That's right. But you're right. I mean, so when I'm thinking, I mean, I do this a lot, right? When, you know, because I have a fairly good memory. So thinking back to what it was like when I was, you know, that age or that age, where I was in this place or that place. And I'm always thinking, oh, right, what does that mean for me now? Or what does that mean for what I want to be? I mean, I'm very much, along your lines about nostalgia is not just backward looking. It's a prompt to think about who you are now and what you could be in the future. Absolutely differently. I mean, I think it's different now. Go back, because we talk about Carry On. People think, I just watched Carry On in 1970s, 1980s sitcoms. Whereas, in fact, I watched a lot of very, very, you know, sharp-edged, you know, left-wing comedy as well. But, I mean, so there's certain things I'm definitely not nostalgic for. I mean, think about Carry On and some of the other things we were talking about. Various social structures and sort of mores in society. Think about those times that there's sort of very kind of everyday racism, homophobia. That's a very different sort of thing. I'm definitely not nostalgic for that. But it's interesting still reflecting on that and thinking about, which is what we do, right? Thinking about what we were like then. What are we like now? What are we going to be like for the future? I mean, there's often that line about, you know, veganism, vegetarianism, whereas, you know, meat eating seems to be acceptable now, but what will we look like to people 50 years hence? How will they criticise our society? And many people put the argument that they'll look at the amount of factory farming that there is and they'll condemn our society for it, even though it seems kind of very every day.
Yeah, and I find that when I'm thinking back on things that have happened, Of course, some of them are very good and positive and wholesome, and some of them are actually things that you wouldn't want to relive. But this, for me, quest for authenticity, for integrity, is what it's all about. It's about the inner you. And sometimes in a world where you might feel things a little bit too marketed or too commercialized or too commodified, there's a sense of, you know, what is it that makes us tick, or what floats our boat, to paraphrase one of my previous interviewees. And I think that it's that sense that no matter whether you're 4 or 44, you kind of feel that you're connecting with something that makes you distinctive. And I think that it's the loss of that. And Tim Strangleman, who works in SSPSSR, mm-hmm. does some work on nostalgia and railway workers, right. and the sense of, and relevant in terms of my dad, of how the railway industry changes over time, and what it is that we feel that in looking back, what we're really saying is we want to reclaim something that is intrinsic to what gives us that professional skill and that camaraderie, which the perception is no longer there.
Yeah, and you can say the same about universities, right? I mean, hearing, you know, your previous interviews, people talking about, you know, just in the time they've been here, how our universities changed, but also how universities have changed across the higher education sector in this country and elsewhere in the last few years. Right? It's, you know, you can be nostalgic for certain things, but also there are certain things now, think about my 15 years here at Kent, where I think we do things better now. But I'm still nostalgic for certain things, even so, let alone reading campus novels of the 60s and 70s and thinking, well, you know, it'd be nice if you could still do that like that.
Oh yeah, I mean there's always a place for a David Lodge novel. He's like, yeah, come on, why do you have to call it rummage? Come on, we know what you mean. Yeah, just a couple more questions. Would you say that you have fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young? Perhaps do you entertain thoughts about doing something different with your life that may be in keeping with maybe what you dreamed about doing as a child or at university?
Right, so have I fulfilled the dreams I had as a kid? Yeah, mostly. And in fact, that's something that weighs, not heavily, I mean, you know, weighs with me, that actually, you know, I mentioned earlier on that when I was about 18, I thought, you know, actually I fancied going into academia and being a philosopher. And look, here I am. I mean, the number of professional philosophers in this country have put up jobs, what, there's about 600 of us, 700 of us. And it's amazing that I've ended up being one of those people. I mean, it really is fantastic. In that sense, then yeah, that sort of dream I had as a kid, and then, you know, then I look at the, you know, my, you know, away from my career, you know, the really important things, right? So I'm, you know, married with two kids and a nice house in a, you know, nice village, and we do nice things. I mean that's just, I mean, I am the cat that got the cream. So in terms of those things, there's nothing that I feel like I haven't done. I mean, there's kind of, you know, facetious answers. So I'll never probably now captain Wolverhampton Wanderers and win the FA Cup or the Champions League. Or captain England at cricket at Lord's. So that's not, I think now I'm 44, those, I'm just about, those days are gone, unfortunately. But there's other things I get to do. So I mean, I always want to do lots of, you know, entertain people, you know, stand-up comedy, and I get to do that, you know, in the village every year. It's a big thing, the pantomime. So, you know, there's loads of things where I feel that, you know, I'm very fulfilled, and that's really important.
No, yeah. If you said to me 40 years ago, what would you like to do? I'd say, oh, I'd like to present the charts on a Sunday evening. 40 years on, I think I'd like to do Pick of the Pops on a Saturday lunchtime. Right. So, you know, you can see the trajectory there. Hugely different. last question. Would you say, and this is the question I asked my previous interviewee, and we're on off another 20 minutes, so you can answer. So I'm going to ask the same question.
Yeah. I'm going to do the Rollinson swerve and keep it going.
Yeah, no, he did. But I asked him the question. I'm going to stick with it, because the question was, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person? And in a way, it's perhaps the sort of question that's deliberately meant, you know, not necessarily as a binary, but as a sort of reflective sweep that sort of also draws on your hopes and anticipations, right, for the future.
I'm definitely half and half. You know, I've got lots of very good memories because I've had a very good life, and you know, I think about those, dwell on them. I mean, even only yesterday I was talking to someone, because the World Cup started yesterday, and I was talking about, you know, one of my most treasured you know, possessions, which is my completed Mexico 86 Panini sticker album. I was the first kid in school to complete this album. Still got it. And you know, all those sort of things, very much looking back and doing that, but looking forward as well. So I'm always thinking about, you know, what we might do as a family, you know, what's going to happen to my kids, you know, and then think about, you know, what I want to do in my career, you know, where we might want to visit, all those sort of things. But actually, it's the interplay between the two that I think is really important. Because I'm thinking about these, with the sort of childhood I had, what's the childhood my kids are having, and what could they carry on doing. What I was hoping to do previously in my career, in my philosophical work, in my creative work, or what do I still want to do? So there's a real interplay between those two. So I'm very much 50-50. But interestingly for me, it's not a binary. It's very much the two playing off against each other, really.
Well, you're a lot easier to interview than my predecessor. No.
Absolutely.
And you also finished with an inadvertent double entendre. You said, carry on doing.
Did I?
So there we are. So on a perfect way to end. Thank you. That's been brilliant. Thank you, Simon Kirchin.
Okay, thanks, Chris.